Chapter 7. For some reason or other, the house was crowded that night, and the fat Jew manager who met them at the door was beaming from ear to ear with an oily, tremulous smile. He escorted them to their box with a sort of pompous humility, waving his fat, jewelled hands and talking at the top of his voice. Dorian Gray loathed him more than ever. He felt as if he had come to look for Miranda and had been met by Caliban. Lord Henry, upon the other hand, rather liked him. At least he declared he did, and insisted upon shaking him by the hand and assuring him that he was proud to meet a man who had discovered a real genius and gone bankrupt over a poet. Hallward amused himself with watching the faces in the pit. The heat was terribly oppressive, and the huge sunlight flamed like a monstrous dahlia with petals of yellow fire. The youths in the gallery had taken off their coats and waistcoats and hung them over the side. They talked to each other across the theatre and shared their oranges with the tawdry girls who sat beside them. Some women were laughing in the pit. Their voices were horribly shrill and discordant. The sound of the popping of corks came from the bar. "What a place to find one's divinity in," said Lord Henry. "Yes," answered Dorian Gray. "It was here I found her, and she's divine beyond all living things. When she acts, you will forget everything. These common rough people, with their coarse faces and brutal gestures, become quite different when she's on the stage. They sit silently and watch her. They weep and laugh as she wills them to do. She makes them as responsive as a violin. She spiritualizes them, and one feels that they are of the same flesh and blood as oneself." "The same flesh and blood as oneself? Oh, I hope not," exclaimed Lord Henry, who was scanning the occupants of the gallery through his opera glass. "Don't pay any attention to him, Dorian," said the painter. "I understand what you mean, and I believe in this girl. Anyone you love must be marvellous, and any girl that has the effect you describe must be fine and noble. To spiritualize one's age, that is something worth doing. If this girl can give a soul to those who have lived without one, she can create the sense of beauty in people whose lives have been sordid and ugly. If she can strip them of their selfishness and lend them tears for sorrows that are not their own, she is worthy of all your adoration, worthy of the adoration of the world. The marriage is quite right." "I did not think so at first, but I admit it now. The gods made Sybil Vane for you. Without her, you would have been incomplete." "Thanks, Basil," answered Dorian Gray, pressing his hand. "I knew that you would understand me. Harry is so cynical, he terrifies me. But here is the orchestra. It is quite dreadful, but it only lasts for about 5 minutes. Then the curtain rises, and you will see to the girl to whom I am going to give all my life, to whom I have given everything that is good in me." A quarter of an hour afterwards, amidst an extraordinary turmoil of applause, Sybil Vane stepped on the stage. Yes, she was certainly lovely to look at, one of the loveliest creatures, Lord Henry thought, that he had ever seen. There was something of the fawn in her shy grace and startled eyes. A faint blush, like the shadow of a rose in a mirror of silver, came to her cheeks as she glanced at the crowded, enthusiastic house. She stepped back a few paces, and her lips seemed to tremble. Basil Hallward leapt to his feet and began to applaud. Motionless, and as one in a dream, sat Dorian Gray, gazing at her. Lord Henry peered through his glasses, murmuring, "Charming, charming." The scene was the hall of Capulet's house, and Romeo in his pilgrim's dress had entered with Mercutio and his other friends. The band, such as it was, struck up a few bars of music, and the dance began. Through the crowd of ungainly, shabbily dressed actors, Sybil Vane moved like a creature from a finer world. Her body swayed while she danced, as a plant sways in the water. The curves of her throat were the curves of a white lily. Her hands seemed to be made of cool ivory. Yet she was curiously listless. She showed no sign of joy when her eyes rested on Romeo. The few words she had to speak, "Good pilgrim, you do wrong your hand too much. Which manly devotion shows in this? For saints have hands that pilgrims' hands do touch, and palm to palm is holy palmer's kiss." With the brief dialogue that follows was spoken in thoroughly artificial manner. The voice was exquisite, but from the point of view of tone, it was absolutely false. It was wrong in colour. It took away all the life from the verse. It made the passion unreal. Dorian Gray grew pale as he watched her. He was puzzled and anxious. Neither of his friends dared to say anything to him. She seemed to them to be absolutely incompetent. They were horribly disappointed. Yet they felt that the true test of any Juliet is the balcony scene of the second act. They waited for that. If she failed there, there was nothing in her. She looked charming as she came out in the moonlight. That could not be denied. But the staginess of her acting was unbearable and grew worse as she went on. Her gestures became absurdly artificial. She overemphasized everything that she had to say. The beautiful passage, "Thou knowest the mask of night is on my face. Else would a maiden blush bepaint my cheek. For that which thou hast heard me speak tonight," was declaimed with the painful precision of a schoolgirl who's been taught to recite by some second-rate professor of elocution. When she leaned over the balcony and came to those wonderful lines, "Although I join thee, I have no joy of this contract tonight. It is too rash, too unadvised, too sudden, too like the lightning which doth cease to be, ere one can say, it lightens. Sweet, good night. This bud of love by summer's ripening breath may prove a beauteous flower when next we meet." She spoke the words as though they conveyed no meaning to her. It was not nervousness. Indeed, far from being nervous, she was absolutely self-contained. It was simply bad art. She was an absolute failure. Even the common, uneducated audience of the pit and gallery lost their interest in the play. They got restless and began to talk loudly and to whistle. The Jew manager, who was standing at the back of the dress circle, stamped and swore with rage. The only person unmoved was the girl herself. When the second act was over, there came a storm of hisses, and Lord Henry got up from his chair and put on his coat. "She's quite beautiful, Dorian," he said, "but she can't act. Let us go." "I'm going to see the play through," answered the lad, in a hard, bitter voice. "I'm awfully sorry that I've made you waste an evening, Harry. I apologize to you both." "My dear Dorian, I should think Miss Vane was ill," interrupted Hallward. "We will come some other night." "I wish she were ill," he rejoined. "But she seems to me to be simply callous and cold. She is entirely altered. Last night she was a great artist. This evening she is merely a commonplace, mediocre actress." "Don't talk like that about anyone you love, Dorian. Love is a more wonderful thing than art." "They are both simply forms of imitation," remarked Lord Henry. "But do let us go, Dorian. You must not stay here any longer. It is not good for one's morals to see bad acting. Besides, I don't suppose you will want your wife to act. So what does it matter if she plays Juliet like a wooden doll? She's very lovely, and if she knows as little about life as she does about acting, she will be a delightful experience. There are only two kinds of people who are really fascinating. People who know absolutely everything, and people who know absolutely nothing. Good heavens, my dear boy, don't look so tragic. The secret of remaining young is to never have an emotion that is unbecoming. Come to the club with Basil and myself. We will smoke cigarettes and drink to the beauty of Sybil Vane. She's beautiful. What more can you want?" "Go away, Harry," cried the lad. "I want to be alone. Basil, you must go. Ah, can't you see that my heart is breaking?" Then hot tears came to his eyes. His lips trembled, and rushing to the back of the box, he leaned up against the wall, hiding his face in his hands. "Let us go, Basil," said Lord Henry, with a strange tenderness in his voice, and the two young men passed out together. A few moments afterwards the floodlights flared up, and the curtain rose on the third act. Dorian Gray went back to his seat. He looked pale and proud and indifferent. The play dragged on, and seemed interminable. Half of the audience went out, tramping in heavy boots and laughing. The whole thing was a fiasco. The last act was played to almost empty benches. The curtain went down on a titter and some groans. As soon as it was over, Dorian Gray rushed behind the scenes into the green room. The girl was standing there alone, with a look of triumph on her face. Her eyes were lit with an exquisite fire. There was a radiance about her. Her parted lips were smiling over some secret of their own. When he entered, she looked at him, and an expression of infinite joy came over her. "How badly I acted tonight, Dorian," she cried. "Horribly," he answered, gazing at her in amazement. "Horribly. It was dreadful." "Are you ill? You have no idea what it was. You have no idea what I suffered." The girl smiled. "Dorian," she answered, lingering over his name with long-drawn music in her voice, as though it was sweeter than honey to the red petals of her mouth. "Dorian, you should have understood. But you understand me now, don't you?" "Understand what?" he asked angrily. "Why I was so bad tonight? Why shall I always be bad? Why shall I never act well again?" He shrugged his shoulders. "You are ill, I suppose. When you're ill, you shouldn't act. You make yourself ridiculous. My friends were bored. I was bored." She seemed not to listen to him. She was transfigured with joy. An ecstasy of happiness dominated her. "Dorian, Dorian," she cried. "Before I knew you, acting was the one reality of my life. It was only in the theatre that I lived. I thought that it all was true. I was Rosalind one night and Portia the other. The joy of Beatrice was my joy, and the sorrows of Cordelia were mine also. I believed in everything. The common people who acted with me seemed to be godlike. The painted scenes were my world. I knew nothing but shadows, and I thought them real. You came, oh my beautiful love, and you freed my soul from prison. You taught me what reality really is. Tonight, for the first time in my life, I saw through the hollowness, the sham, the silliness of the empty pageant in which I had always played. Tonight, for the first time, I became conscious that the Romeo was hideous and old and painted, that the moonlight in the orchard was false, that the scenery was vulgar, and that the words I had to speak were unreal, were not my words, were not what I wanted to say. You had brought me something higher, something of which all art is but a reflection. You had made me understand what love really is. My love, Prince Charming, Prince of Life. I have grown sick of shadows. You are more to me than all art can ever be. What have I to do with the puppets of a play? When I came on tonight, I could not understand how it was that everything had gone from me. I thought that I was going to be wonderful. I found that I could do nothing. Suddenly it dawned on my soul what it all meant. The knowledge was exquisite to me. I heard them hissing and I smiled. What could they know of a love such as ours? Take me away, Dorian. Take me away with you, where we can be quite alone. I hate the stage. I might mimic a passion that I do not feel, but I cannot mimic one that burns me like fire. Oh, Dorian, Dorian, you can understand now what it signifies. Even if I could do it, it would be profanation for me to play at being in love. You've made me see that. He flung himself down on the sofa and turned away his face. You've killed my love, he muttered. She looked at him in wonder and laughed. He made no answer. She came across to him and with her little fingers stroked his hair. She knelt down and pressed his hands to her lips. He drew them away and a shudder ran through him. Then he leapt up and went to the door. Yes, he cried. You've killed my love. You used to stir my imagination. Now you don't even stir my curiosity. You simply produce no effect. I loved you because you were marvellous, because you had genius and intellect, because you realised the dreams of great poets and gave shape and substance to the shadows of art. You've thrown it all away. You're shallow and stupid. My God, how mad I was to love you. What a fool I've been. You're nothing to me now. I will never see you again. I will never think of you. I will never mention your name. You don't know what you were to me once. Why, once? Oh, I can't bear to think of it. I wish I had never laid eyes upon you. You've spoiled the romance of my life. How little you can know of love. If you say it mars your art. Without your art you're nothing. I would have made you famous, splendid, magnificent. The world would have worshipped you, and you would have borne my name. What are you now, a third-rate actress with a pretty face? The girl grew white and trembled. She clenched her hands together, and her voice seemed to catch in her throat. You're not serious, Dorian, she murmured. You're acting. Acting. I leave that to you. You do it so well, he answered bitterly. She rose from her knees and with a piteous expression of pain in her face came across the room to him. She put her hand upon his arm and looked into his eyes. He thrust her back. Don't touch me, he cried. A low moan broke from her and she flung herself at his feet and lay there like a trampled flower. Dorian, Dorian, don't leave me, she whispered. I'm so sorry I didn't act well. I was thinking of you all the time. But I will try, indeed I will try. It came so suddenly across me, my love for you. I think I should never have known it if you'd not kissed me, if we'd not kissed each other. Kiss me again, my love. Don't go away from me, I couldn't bear it. Oh, don't go away from me. My brother, no, never mind, he didn't mean it. He was in jest. But you, can't you forgive me for tonight? I will work so hard and try to improve. Don't be cruel to me because I love you better than anything in the world. After all, it's only once that I've not pleased you. But you're quite right, Dorian. I should have shown myself more of an artist. It was foolish of me, and yet I couldn't help it. Oh, don't leave me, don't leave me. A fit of passionate sobbing choked her. She crouched on the floor like a wounded thing, and Dorian Gray, with his beautiful eyes, looked down at her, and his chiseled lips curled in exquisite disdain. There is always something ridiculous about the emotions of people who want to cease to love. Sybil Vane to him seemed to be absurdly melodramatic. Her tears and sobs annoyed him. "I'm going," he said at last, in his calm, clear voice. "I don't wish to be unkind, but I can't see you again. You've disappointed me." She wept silently and made no answer, but crept nearer. Her little hand stretched blindly out and appeared to be seeking for him. He turned on his heel and left the room. In a few minutes, he was out of the theatre. Where he went to, he hardly knew. He remembered wandering through dimly lit streets, past gaunt black-shadowed archways and evil-looking houses. Women with hoarse voices and harsh laughter had called after him. Drunkards had reeled by cursing and chattering to themselves like monstrous apes. He'd seen grotesque children huddled upon doorsteps and heard shrieks and oaths from gloomy courts. As the dawn was just breaking, he found himself close to Covent Garden. The darkness lifted, and, flushed with faint fires, the sky hollowed itself into a perfect pearl. Huge carts filled with nodding lilies rumbled slowly down the polished empty street. The air was heavy with the perfume of the flowers, and their beauty seemed to bring him an anodyne for his pain. He followed into the market and watched the men unloading their wagons. A white-smocked carter offered him some cherries. He thanked him and wondered why he refused to accept any money for them, and began to eat them listlessly. They had been plucked at midnight, and the coldness of the moon had entered into them. A long line of boys carrying crates of striped tulips and of yellow and red roses defiled in front of him, threading their way through the huge jade-green piles of vegetables. Under the portico, with its grey sun-bleached pillars, loitered a troop of draggled, bare-headed girls, waiting for the auction to be over. Others crowded round the swinging doors of the coffee house in the piazza. The heavy cart horses slipped and stamped upon the rough stones, shaking their bells and trappings. Some of the drivers were lying asleep on a pile of sacks. Iris-necked and pink-footed, the pigeons ran about picking up seeds. After a little while, he hailed a hansom and drove home. For a few moments, he loitered upon the doorstep, looking round at the silent square with its blank, close-shuttered windows and its staring blinds. The sky was pure opal now, and the roofs of the houses glistened like silver against it. From some chimney opposite, a thin wreath of smoke was rising. It curled, a violet ribboned, through the nacre-coloured air. In the huge gilt Venetian lantern, spoil of some doge's barge, that hung from the ceiling of that great oak-panelled hall of entrance, lights were still burning from three flickering jets. Thin blue petals of flame, they seemed, rimmed with white fire. He turned them out, and, having thrown his hat and cape on the table, passed through the library towards the door of his bedroom, a large octagonal chamber on the ground floor that, in his newborn feeling for luxury, he had just decorated for himself and hung with some curious Renaissance tapestries that had been discovered stored in a disused attic at Selby Royal. As he was turning the handle of the door, his eye fell upon the portrait Basil Hallward had painted of him. He started back as if in surprise. Then he went on to his own room, looking somewhat puzzled. After he'd taken the buttonhole out of his coat, he seemed to hesitate. Finally, he came back, went over to the picture, and examined it. In the dim arrested light that struggled through the cream-coloured silk blinds, the face appeared to him to be a little changed. The expression looked different. One would have said there was a touch of cruelty in the mouth, It was certainly strange. He turned round and, walking to the window, drew up the blind. The bright dawn flooded the room and swept the fantastic shadows into dusky corners where they lay shuddering. But the strange expression that he had noticed in the face of the portrait seemed to linger there, to be more intensified even. The quivering, ardent sunlight showed him the lines of cruelty round the mouth as clearly as if he'd been looking into a mirror after he'd done some dreadful thing. He winced, and taking up from the table an oval glass framed in ivory cupids, one of Lord Henry's many presents to him, glanced hurriedly into its polished depths. No line like that warped his red lips. What did it mean? He rubbed his eyes and came closer to the picture, examining it again. There were no signs of any change when he looked into the actual painting, and yet there was no doubt that the whole expression had altered. It was not a mere fancy of his own. The thing was horribly apparent. He threw himself into a chair and began to think. Suddenly there flashed across his mind what he had said in Basil Hallward's studio the day the picture had been finished. Yes, he remembered it perfectly. He'd uttered a mad wish that he himself might remain young and the portrait grow old, that his beauty might be untarnished and the face on the old canvas bear the burden of his passions and his sins, that the painted image might be seared with the lines of suffering and thought, and that he might keep all the delicate bloom and loveliness of his then just conscious boyhood. Surely his wish had not been fulfilled. Such things were impossible. It seemed monstrous even to think of them. And yet there was the picture before him, with the touch of cruelty in his mouth. Cruelty? Had he been cruel? It was the girl's fault, not his. He had dreamed of her as a great artist, had given his love to her because he thought her great, and then she had disappointed him. She had been shallow and unworthy. And yet, a feeling of infinite regret came over him, as he thought of her lying at his feet sobbing like a little child. He remembered what callousness he had watched her with. Why had he been like that? Why had such a soul been given to him? But he had suffered also. During the 3 terrible hours that the play had lasted, he had lived centuries of pain, eon upon eon of torture. His life was well worth hers. She had married him for a moment, if he had wounded her for an age. Besides, women were better suited to bear sorrow than men. They lived on their emotions. They only thought of their emotions. When they took lovers, it was merely to have someone with whom they could have scenes. Lord Henry had told him that, and Lord Henry knew what women were. Why should he trouble about Sybil Vane? She was nothing to him now. But the picture, what was he to say of that? It held the secret of his life and told his story. It had taught him to love his own beauty. Would it teach him to loathe his own soul? Would he ever look at it again? No, it was merely an illusion wrought on the troubled senses. The horrible night that he had passed had left phantoms behind it. Suddenly there had fallen upon his brain that tiny scarlet speck that makes men mad. The picture had not changed. It was folly to think so. Yet it was watching him, with its beautiful marred face and its cruel smile. Its bright hair gleamed in the early sunlight. Its blue eyes met his own. A sense of infinite pity, not for himself, but for the painted image of himself, came over him. It had altered already, and would alter more. Its gold would wither into grey. Its red and white roses would die. For every sin he committed, a stain would fleck and wreck its fairness. But he would not sin. The picture, changed or unchanged, would be to him the visible emblem of conscience. He would resist temptation. He would not even see Lord Henry anymore, would not, at any rate, listen to those subtle, poisonous theories that in Basil Hallward's garden had first stirred within him the passion for impossible things. He would go back to Sybil Vane, make her amends, marry her, try to love her again. Yes, it was his duty to do so. She must have suffered more than he had. Poor child, he had been selfish and cruel to her. The fascination that she had exercised over him would return. They would be happy together. His life with her would be beautiful and pure. He got up from his chair and drew a large screen right in front of the portrait, shuddering as he glanced at it. How horrible, he murmured to himself. He walked across the window and reopened it. When he stepped out onto the grass, he drew a deep breath. The fresh morning air seemed to drive away all of his sombre passions. He thought only of Sybil. A faint echo of his love came back to him. He repeated her name over and over again. The birds that were singing in the dew-drenched garden seemed to be telling the flowers about her. Chapter 8. It was long past noon when he awoke. His valet had crept several times on tiptoe into the room to see if he was stirring, and had wondered what had made his young master sleep so late. Finally, his bell sounded, and Victor came softly in with a cup of tea and a pile of letters. On a small tray of old Sèvres cinema, and drew back the olive satin curtains with their shimmering blue lining that hung in front of the three tall windows. "Monsieur has slept well this morning," he said, smiling. "What o'clock is it, Victor?" asked Dorian Gray drowsily.
1 hour and a quarter, monsieur."
"How late it was." He sat up, and having sipped some tea, turned over his letters. One of them was from Lord Henry, and had been brought by hand that morning. He hesitated for a moment, and then put it aside. The others he opened listlessly. They contained the usual collection of cards, invitations to dinner, tickets for private views, programmes of charity concerts and the like, that are showered on fashionable young men every morning during the season. It was a rather heavy bill for a chased silver Louis Quinze toilet set that had not yet had the courage to send on to his guardians, who were extremely old-fashioned people and did not realise that we live in an age where unnecessary things are our only necessities, and that there were several very courteously worded communications from Jermyn Street money lenders offering to advance any sum of money at a moment's notice and at the most reasonable rates of interest. After about 10 minutes he got up and, throwing on an elaborate dressing gown of silk embroidered cashmere wool, passed into the onyx-paved bathroom. The cool water refreshed him after his long sleep. He seemed to have forgotten all that he had gone through. A dim sense of having taken part in some strange tragedy came to him once or twice, but there was the unreality of a dream about it. As soon as he was dressed, he went into the library and sat down to a light French breakfast that had been laid out for him at a small round table close to an open window. It was an exquisite day. The warm air seemed laden with spices. A bee flew in, and buzzed round the blue dragon bowl that filled with sulphur yellow roses stood before him. He felt perfectly happy. Suddenly his eye fell on the screen that had been placed in front of the portrait, and he started. "Too cold for monsieur?" asked his valet, putting an omelette on the table. "I shut the window?" Dorian shook his head. "I'm not cold," he murmured. Was it all true? Had the portrait really changed? Or had it been simply his own imagination that had made him see a look of evil when there had been a look of joy? Surely a painted canvas could not alter. The thing was absurd. It would serve as a tale to tell Basil some day. It would make him smile. And yet, how vivid was his recollection of the whole thing. First in the dim twilight, and then in the bright dawn, he had seen the touch of cruelty round the warped lips. He almost dreaded his valet leaving the room. He knew that when he was alone he would have to examine the portrait. He was afraid of certainty. When the coffee and cigarettes had been brought and the man turned to go, he felt a wild desire to tell him to remain. As the door was closing behind him, he called him back. The man stood waiting for his orders. Dorian looked at him for a moment. "I am not at home to anyone, Victor," he said with a sigh. The man bowed and retired. Then he rose from the table, lit a cigarette, and flung himself down on the luxuriously cushioned couch that stood facing the screen. The screen was an old one, of gilt Spanish leather, stamped and wrought with a rather florid Louis XIV pattern. He scanned it curiously, wondering if it had ever before concealed the secret of a man's life. Should he move it aside, after all? Why not let it stay there? What was the use of knowing? If the thing was true, it was terrible. If it was not true, why trouble about it? But what if, by some fate or deadlier chance, eyes other than his spied behind and saw the horrible change? What should he do if Basil Hallward came and asked to look at his own picture? Basil would be sure to do that. No, the thing had to be examined, and at once. Anything would be better than this dreadful state of doubt. He got up and locked both doors. At least he would be alone when he looked up on the mask of his shame. Then he drew the screen aside and saw himself face to face. It was perfectly true. The portrait had altered.
As he often remembered afterwards, and always with no small wonder, he found himself at first gazing at the portrait with a feeling of almost scientific interest. That a change should have taken place was incredible to him, and yet it was a fact. Was there some subtle affinity between the chemical atoms that shaped themselves into form and colour on the canvas, and the soul that was within him? Could it be that what soul thought, they realised, that what it dreamed, they made true? Or was there some other, more terrible reason? He shuddered and felt afraid, going back to the couch, lay there, gazing at the picture in sickened horror. One thing, however, he felt that it had done for him. It had made him conscious how unjust, how cruel he had been to Sybil Vane. It was not too late to make reparation for that. She could still be his wife. His unreal and selfish love would yield to some higher influence, would be transformed into some nobler passion, and the portrait that Basil Hallward had painted of him would be to guide him through life, would be to him what holiness is to some and conscience to others, and the fear of God is to us all. There were opiates for remorse, drugs that could lull the moral sense to sleep. But here was a visible sign of the degradation of sin. Here was an ever-present sign of the ruin men brought upon their souls. 3 o'clock struck, and four, and the half-hour rang its double chime, but Dorian Gray did not stir. He was trying to gather up the scarlet threads of life, and to weave them into a pattern, to find his way through the sanguine labyrinth of passion through which he was wandering. He did not know what to do, or what to think. Finally, he went over to the table and wrote a passionate letter to the girl he had loved, imploring her forgiveness and accusing himself of madness. He covered page after page with wild words of sorrow and wilder words of pain. There is a luxury in self-reproach. When we blame ourselves, we feel that no one else has a right to blame us. It is the confession, not the priest, that gives us absolution. When Dorian had finished the letter, he felt that he had been forgiven. Suddenly there came a knock at the door, and he heard Lord Henry's voice outside. "My dear boy, I must see you. Let me in at once. I can't bear you shutting yourself up like this." He made no answer at first, but remained quite still. The knocking still continued and grew louder. Yes, it was better to let Lord Henry in, and to explain to him the new life he was going to lead, to quarrel with him if it became necessary to quarrel, to part if parting was inevitable. He jumped up, drew the screen hastily across the picture, and unlocked the door. "I'm so sorry for it all," said Lord Henry as he entered, "but you must not think too much about it." "Do you mean about Sybil Vane?" asked the lad. "Yes, of course," answered Lord Henry, sinking into a chair and slowly pulling off his yellow gloves. "It is dreadful from one point of view, but it was not your fault. Tell me, did you go behind and see her after the play was over?" "Yes, I felt sure you had. Did you make a scene with her?" "I was brutal, Harry, perfectly brutal. But it is all right now. I'm not sorry for anything that has happened. It has taught me to know myself better." "Oh, Dorian, I'm so glad you take it in that way. I was afraid I would find you plunged in remorse, tearing that nice curly hair of yours." "I've got through all that," said Dorian, shaking his head and smiling. "I'm perfectly happy now. I know what conscience is, to begin with. It's not what you told me it was. It's the divinest thing in us. Don't sneer at it, Harry, any more. At least not before me. I don't want to be good. I can't bear the idea of my soul being hideous." "A very charming artistic basis for ethics, Dorian. I congratulate you on it. But how are you going to begin?" "By marrying Sybil Vane." "Marrying Sybil Vane?" cried Lord Henry, standing up and looking at him in perplexed amazement. "But my dear Dorian..." "Yes, Harry, I know what you're going to say. Something dreadful about marriage. Don't say it. Don't ever say things of that kind to me again. 2 days ago I asked Sybil to marry me. I'm not going to break my word to her. She is to be my wife."
"Your wife, Dorian? Didn't you get my letter? I wrote to you this morning and sent the note down by my own man."
"Your letter? Oh yes, I remember. I've not read it yet, Harry. I was afraid there might be something in it I wouldn't like.
You cut life into pieces with your epigrams."
"Do you know nothing then? What do you mean?" Lord Henry walked across the room and, sitting by Dorian Gray, took both his hands in his own and held them tightly. "Dorian, my letter, don't be frightened, was to tell you that Sybil Vane is dead."
A cry of pain broke from the lad's lips, and he leaped to his feet, tearing his hands away from Lord Henry's grasp. "Dead? Sybil dead? It is not true. It is a horrible lie. How dare you say it?" "It's quite true, Dorian," said Lord Henry gravely. "It is in all the morning papers. I wrote down to you to ask you not to see anyone till I came. There will have to be an inquest, of course, and you must not be mixed up in it. Things like that make a man fashionable in Paris, but in London people are so prejudiced. Here one should never make one's debut with a scandal. One should reserve that to give an interest to one's old age. I suppose they don't know your name at the theatre. If they don't, it is all right. Did anyone see you going round to her room? That is an important point." Dorian did not answer for a few moments. He was dazed with horror. Finally, he stammered in a stifled voice, "Harry, did you say an inquest? What did you mean by that? Did Sybil... Oh, Harry, I can't bear it. But be quick. Tell me everything at once." "I have no doubt that it was not an accident, Dorian, though it must be put in that way to the public. It seems that as she was leaving the theatre with her mother, about 12:30 or so, she said she'd forgotten something upstairs. They waited some time for her, but she did not come down again. They ultimately found her lying dead on the floor of her dressing room. She had swallowed something by mistake, some dreadful thing they use at theatres. I don't know what it was. It was either prussic acid or white lead in it. I should fancy it was prussic acid, as she seems to have died instantaneously." "Harry, Harry, it's horrible," cried the lad. "Yes, it's very tragic, of course, but you must not get yourself mixed up in it. I see by the standards she was 17. I should have thought she was almost younger than that. She looked such a child and seemed to know so little about acting. Dorian, you mustn't let this thing get on your nerves. You must come and dine with me, and afterwards we will look in the opera. It's a party night, and everybody will be there. You can come to my sister's box. She's got some smart women with her." "So I've murdered Sybil Vane," said Dorian Gray.